Welcome to Full Potential, Thriving with Neurodiversities. I'm your host, Sarah Intonato. This podcast teaches parents of children with neurodiversities, such as autism, ADHD, learning disabilities, and beyond, to support their kids in reaching their full potential so that they can thrive, instead of letting stereotypes define them. My mission is to end suffering amongst these parents by giving them the tools to heal themselves, which in turn empowers them to be bold, confident advocates for their children. By addressing a variety of topics, such as well-being, advocacy, and spirituality, these parents stop being the victims of a broken system and instead succeed in providing their unique children with exactly what they need to thrive and share their gifts with the world. One by one, these families now change the world through their uniqueness instead of being victimized by it. Are you ready? Let's get started. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I'm so excited to have a very special guest, one that I've wanted to bring to this audience for a long time, and that is Ms. Susan Deedy. She is, without further ado, a special education attorney here in the state of New York, and we are going to have a honest conversation today about things you need to know as a parent to a child with any need, not just autism or ADHD, but any need to make sure that you're supporting your child in the best possible way. I first had a conversation with Susan about 2 years ago. And one of the things that really stood out to me about you, Susan, is that I'd spoken to other attorneys over the years and many of them knew their stuff, but I also found them to be, the word that I would use is a hothead. Like, they knew their stuff, but they were also very combative. And I know enough about relationship development and about coaching and consulting to know that when you start getting combative, people stop listening to you. So what really stood out to me when I first conversed with Susan was that she clearly knew her stuff. She was well-versed in the law, but she was calm and steady and didn't need to get overly excited or emotional to make people listen to her. She just has this commanding presence about her that I certainly aspire to have when I'm having high stakes conversations. So I have a lot of trust for Susan's breadth of knowledge and the way she presents herself in the world. So Susan, thank you for joining us today. Is there anything you would like to add to the introduction that I might've left out?
No, thank you for that introduction. I've been representing parents of students with disabilities for many, many years. It's my passion, and it's really one of the most rewarding jobs. And I think if you're going to be an attorney, it's the best area of law to practice, for sure. But thank you for your introduction.
It's my pleasure. I know we have a wide variety of parents listening whose children have all different kinds of needs and disabilities. I also know that many of them are parents like me whose children are non-speakers or have limited speaking ability. So I know that there will be pieces that make this particular audience go, that are food for thought for them that I'm going to bring up right away. And one of those things is the frustration level that many parents of non-speakers have when their child is not being supported sufficiently by their school district, to the point where I've seen so many parents end up homeschooling their children because they're so challenged by the status quo, or their child is, say, 13, but receiving kindergarten level schoolwork. And it seems like for whatever reason, there is not a common ground being found. And I see it more and more. And what's interesting with this audience is I've also had many parents who are doing this homeschooling because they're so frustrated with their district say things to me like, I really don't want homeschool. I really would love my child to go to school and be supported, but it seems like that's not possible. So I would love to just dive in right here, which is a meaty conversation, and hear about what you have to say, and have you seen this yourself?
Well, I have, for sure. And, you know, just to start off with regard to home instruction or homeschooling, which is different from home instruction.
Right.
And that's a distinction that parents need to actually be aware of. Homeschooling is really a situation where a parent is withdrawing their child from the public schools and affirmatively taking steps to educate that child, you know, according to, you know, state education guidelines. And but you're removing sort of the obligation from the school district, you know, and taking this on yourselves. Now, in some situations that, you know, that might may be the way to go, but I feel that parents need to sort of understand clearly, you know, the ramifications and what homeschooling really, really means. I mean, first off, as we know, it's a very restrictive kind of a setting, right? It's, you know, if it is happening in the home, the student is away from neurotypical peers or, you know, classmates. This routine is different from getting up and getting on a school bus, and there's social aspects to that. So, you know, it can be less than ideal in many ways. The other piece that I hear when parents do choose this route is it's just really not sustainable for many parents for a period of time. I mean, you know, when your child is younger, you know, it can be more sustainable. But as the workload increases, the demands and, you know, the subject matter gets more complex. And again, even the social piece is, you know, there's so many pieces to it. So, you know, I feel as though parents need to sort of understand what it means if they're opting for homeschooling. You know, the other piece that I mentioned initially is, you know, when you're doing that, what you're doing is you're taking matters into your own hands. And what the law requires, there's a whole body of law, the federal IDEA, as well as the state law and regulations, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which has its own federal regulations, as well as Article 89 of the New York State Education Law, you know, imposes upon your public school district a whole host of sort of obligations in order to provide any child that has been deemed eligible to receive special education services with a free, appropriate public education. So that is the school your school district's obligation. And so, you know, my feeling is that before a parent, you know, sort of opts to take such an extreme measure and take on educating their child, that they go through the process of, you know, let's try to work with the district to ensure that my public school district provides my child with a FAPE, free appropriate public education. And one of the biggest pieces that I recommend is, look, your school district has a right, and they're going to evaluate your child and make and determine your child's needs and develop an IEP. But sometimes when a student is complex and has a variety of issues, a more comprehensive evaluation is very helpful in guiding educational programming. And so parents can request that their school district undertake an independent educational evaluation after they perform their initial evaluation, in order to get a more comprehensive view. And, you know, very often the independent and educational evaluations, which is also referred to as an IEE, you know, these evaluators often will administer additional tests to really get a bigger picture. For example, there are very specific tests that hone in on a student's executive functioning needs and attention and, you know, concept shifting. There's all these very particular subtests. Pragmatic testing. You know, so we're talking about and diagnostic testing that really goes that sometimes are in the form of questionnaires, but when tallied up, it gives us a really big picture of some of what we're not seeing by just sort of standardized testing, you know, IQ scores.
So parents, what I want you to process from this chunk right here conversation is that the initial evaluations that are commonly done are not the only evaluations that exist to give a full picture of your child's capabilities. This probably explains why many parents feel like, okay, we did this testing and it's given, you know, some type of information for my child's educational trajectory, but I don't agree with all of it, or my child shows me more at home that these tests don't really articulate. And what Susan is saying is that you can ask for independent evaluations to get a deeper picture of what's beneath the surface. Is that a correct summary, Susan?
Yeah, that's right. And the other option is that parents can always on their own pay for on their own a private evaluation if there's a specific evaluator but that they know of. But you know, I will say that it is important that the evaluator that performs the comprehensive testing is one that, you know, typically does this sort of evaluation, is very, you know, accustomed to writing these kinds of reports, is knowledgeable about the continuum of services that exist within the public schools, and not only is knowledgeable about the continuum of services that exist at public schools, but goes beyond that and sort of just looks to, well, what does the child need? Right. Because sometimes there are times when a child's needs may exceed what is provided within the model of the public school system.
So let's pause there for a moment, because I hear this a lot from parents, particularly of non-speakers, but of many different children. They are aware that their child's needs exceed what's commonly provided or what is, you know, readily available in their school. But then they end up feeling like they're between a rock and a hard place because the school's not used to providing it, so they want to either send them somewhere else or just offer them what they might have readily available. And this is where I think sometimes creativity needs to be part of the solution. And that can be its own type of challenge for families and districts in terms of working together. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on this, because one of the things I often hear myself saying to people is, just because your child might be the first person in your district to have this need doesn't mean the district doesn't need to provide for that need. Just because they've never done it before doesn't mean the need's not valid. So I was wondering if you could, when parents kind of throw their hands up and say like, okay, great, we agree that my child has this need, but we don't agree on how to provide for it, where they should go with that, or what types of things they should consider in their next steps.
Well, I think parents need to understand that they are meaningful participants of the CSE team. And by that, I mean, that's defined in the law. They are, you know, that means providing critical information about the student's needs, which, you know, parents know. Being able to sort of, you know, express their concerns and really provide useful information that the team we'll consider for sure.
Yeah.
Look, the reality is that what a lot of this boils down to is that if your school district has players and personnel that are open and willing to work with you, that is more than half the battle. They themselves have to be willing to be creative.
Yeah.
And, you know, and within the confines of the law. I mean, we need to always also remember that school districts are required by law to provide a student a FAPE. And there are, you know, some services and, you know, supports that might be beneficial for your child, but might go beyond what a district is legally obligated to do, to provide. So there are definitely, you know, there's a gray area, you know, and that's also where a team that's willing to work with you and that you have a good relationship with, you know, these things should be worked out between parent and district. You know, you talked a little bit about when should a parent consider bringing in an attorney. And so, you know, one of the pieces I think that parents often consider is, you know, I have a relationship with my district. Do I want to bring a lawyer in? I don't want to, you know, seem adversarial, but yet I want to make sure I get what I need for my child. So, you know, listen, what I will say to that is the first issue is, and really the most important is, yeah, you have a relationship with your district. And if you're a resident of your particular school district and your child has many years ahead, you know, that relationship is very important to foster and to, you know, keep in a positive. That being said, bringing in a lawyer doesn't at all mean that relationship will be distanced.
Right.
As long as, you know, first off, you bring in the right lawyer. There are plenty of attorneys that, you know, handle this area of law more and more now. And everybody has their own style, but it's very important that, you know, you're dealing with people. So it's very important that not only you, but your attorney, in my opinion, you know, takes an approach that does not alienate the district. Because really, 9 times out of 10, you know, your school district, if you feel as though your child isn't getting what they need, your school district isn't, you know, overtly trying to do that.
Right.
What happens is sometimes districts don't know what to do, or they don't know the need, or because it hasn't been tested, or, you know, so there's bringing in an attorney, the right attorney with the, you know, the right sort of way of handling matters could be a very positive thing. And, you know, can actually foster, you know, a resolution to your issues without any sort of, you know, adversarial approach. You know, certainly there's
a question actually on this, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted to make sure we include this. When is, in your opinion, the right time for the family that has a child who's not, you know, little, they've been working with their school district for a while, and they start to feel like they get to a point where they're butting their head against the wall? Are there any hallmarks that you think are really noticeable that should be highlighted by families to say, oh, this might be a sign to have a conversation with an attorney about getting support? Is there anything that really stands out as being the thing or something that's noticeable?
Yeah. Well, some of the things that, you know, we hear and I think would prompt a parent to come in and talk to an attorney is if they feel as though, you know, the situation is status quo and over the course of, you know, several years, they are not seeing progress. That's something that, I think warrants, at least a review of what's happening. It might require, again, go back to further testing to really get a sense of, well, what's happening. And lawyers will know sort of how to, maybe they'll just make a referral to get an IEE or what have you. But a lawyer can certainly point a parent in the right direction. Or, once we find something out about what's happening, what is there a need that's not being met? Go into the CSE meeting with the parent and, discuss it and advocate on behalf of the parents at the CSE meeting. That's one scenario. Certainly, if there's a dispute about a service, if there's a real disagreement, a parent may want to come and speak to an attorney and get a sense. Is this something that I'm entitled to? Is this a valid concern legally? Is it not? Is there maybe something else I'm not thinking of? So certainly if there's a concern or a dispute, parents should, can often come and talk to an attorney. Where there's a change in circumstances, if all of a sudden behaviors start to erupt, not knowing why that is, not getting enough communication perhaps from the district about what's going on in school, that would be something that a parent may want to speak to a lawyer about. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these things that I'm mentioning are, I don't want to say easy, but right, can be worked out by, with people that are knowledgeable in navigating through this system in a way that is not adversarial, where really everybody comes out feeling okay. Like, okay, because the truth is, as we all know, Sarah, it's about the child. And right, it needs to, and in the students is really everybody's interest, and that has to be brought to the team, and it's really usually the case.
Is. And something that you just said that I think is really important to highlight is some of these issues are very straightforward in terms of resolving them. And I think this is an important point, because what I see is that parents of this population have a full plate already, so they are often more overwhelmed than the general population of neurotypical parents. And they often assume, oh, this is going to be another big project. I don't have the bandwidth or the resources to take that on. But how do you know that unless you ask some questions from somebody who's not just your friend or the other people who live in your district, but someone who's actually an expert in this field? They might have a very different response from, Mary down the road, who also has a child in your district who took a different trajectory than you. So I think this is an important point, that you can't make the assumption this is going to be an enormous undertaking if you haven't actually done your research and gathered proper information. And hearsay from your neighbors is not proper information.
That's right.
This is why we hire to help us in anything. You wouldn't take investment advice from your neighbor who's never made an investment. Why would you just take hearsay advice from whoever who also has a child with the same diagnosis? They could be very different children.
Right. Look, I feel like what I hear often also is that these CSE meetings for parents, especially who already have their hands full, as you just pointed out, are very exhausting, and they can be very intimidating because, as a parent, you're sitting around a table with folks that work with your child, some of whom don't work with your child, some of whom have never met your child, administrators, and they're sort of telling you what your child needs and talking perhaps in a lingo with acronyms and scores that you're not familiar with.
Right.
It's very intimidating. I know this. I hear this every day.
Yeah.
I feel very strongly that parents should not go to these meetings feeling intimidated, feeling overwhelmed. And if that means bringing a lawyer, an advocate, somebody who's knowledgeable with them, it's well worth it.
Yeah.
Some of the things that we do before any CSE meeting is something that I advise parents to do on their own. Again, really, parents need to sort of understand, you know, that they are meaningful participants, what their role is, but they can be taught what to do and go to these CSE meetings on their own with the right information.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is doing your homework before that CSE meeting, not just walking into a CSE meeting and then ultimately feeling a little bit ambushed or intimidated by these folks that are now sort of talking about numbers and making recommendations. Okay. So I definitely always recommend that, you know, parents request in advance of any CSE meeting to receive any documents that are going to be reviewed. Often, you know, these documents or tests, assessments are provided at the meeting or right before the meeting. It's important to look at it, digest it, sort of formulate your questions, maybe ask a professional, what does this mean? Ahead of time, preparation is key. Talk to the teachers before the meeting, get a sense of what teachers, you know, are going to say at the meeting, see whether there's anything that you disagree with or you have a concern with, so that can be addressed, or you know sort of where it's heading and you're prepared to address your concerns.
Really powerful. And I also will put on my family coach consultant hat for a moment and say that when you say do your homework, do your prep work, to me as a parent, that also highly involves being a present parent to the issues that you're seeing in the home and working on those and getting support for those. Because what I see is that if parents don't feel like they can control what's happening in their living room, they're not going to go to these meetings and feel confident. Right. Like meaningful participants, they're going to think, I can't even control what's going on in my living room. Why should I act like an expert here when this person has a master's degree in special education? I'm just the mom who's trying to get my kid to sit at the dinner table without having a tantrum. You know, so it's very important from what I've seen in my personal experience to be a guiding force, be a powerful leader in your home as a parent, whether you're a mother or father, because that will give you the confidence beyond a shadow of a doubt that nobody knows your child better than you. If you feel out of control in the home, that energy will show up in your meetings because you won't feel confident saying no, asking questions, being a meaningful participant.
Yeah, right. And, you know, again, being organized before you go to your meeting, writing down and outlining your issues, bring a piece of paper with your issues that you want to address. Things that, you know, you don't want to leave the meeting without informing the team that this is a concern. And then you're going to take notes as to, you know, what was resolved, what is still outstanding, what are we doing, you know, on the issues that might require a few more steps and going back to the, you know, may require coming back so that things don't sort of fall through the cracks.
Yeah. Because because things aren't all resolved in one meeting doesn't mean they can't be resolved. And I think this is also a challenge parents have with the CSE process. They feel like the meeting ends and it's the end all be all. And that's not really true.
That's right. And like I said, very often certain steps have to be taken or an issue will be raised and the district will suggest, oh, let's do a speech and language evaluation to really determine the level of pragmatic needs or what the nuances are so we can develop good goals. You know, okay, that's great. That's one piece. Then let's make sure we get back that evaluation before the next CSE meeting. We look at it carefully. We read it. We think of ourselves. What do you think as a parent? Some goals, what needs to be worked on? So, you know, organization is key, and preparation is key to this process. Mm-hmm. And again, if a parent is so overwhelmed that it's just too much, which could be the case, you know, an advocate, a lawyer will do all of those things for a parent. But very often, as I was saying earlier, sometimes it's not necessary, you know. Some of this stuff is basic, you know, the district does their job, you know, parent does their job, everybody knows their rights and entitlements. And if we have a team that is open and, you know, willing to work and cooperative, you know, things work out.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, this is a perfect, in a perfect world. Right. Obviously, this is not always the case.
Right.
But, you know, the CSE process, I find often is just, it's a stumbling block for parents. And it often also sets a tone.
Yeah.
And could move things in the wrong direction.
One of the things I loved when I first hired a non-attorney advocate when my son was 4 years old, so this is going back 9 years, is that one, she kept track of all my paperwork for me. So I was able to go to the meetings and be organized, but I was behind the scenes able to be a good parent because I wasn't sitting printing out things until 3 a.m. But also when I showed up to those meetings organized and ready to go, my district had a different tone with me. And this was years ago when I lived in a different district. But I remember the stark difference between the previous meeting I'd had with no advocate, with, you know, my folder of printouts that I had versus going to the next meeting with an advocate who had it all organized for me, who was not an attorney, but knew the law, was a parent of an adult child who'd had needs as well. And it sort of made the district say, oh, hang on, we have to take these people seriously. And that greatly changed the outcome of many meetings for years to come. And I cannot emphasize that enough. You would not go to a business meeting or to ask a venture capitalist for funds, you know, disheveled and disorganized and not having done your research. Why would you do that with your child's educational trajectory?
Yeah, I hear that a lot. I hear that a lot myself. And it depends on the district.
Right.
It does. But, you know, another point that I want to emphasize for parents is that, you know, during a CSE meeting, there's a lot of discussion. And, you know, certain points that are made may or may not make its way into the IEP. So certain, you know, recommendations will go into the IEP in a certain format, not in perhaps the format that parents may want. For example, you know, if a student benefits from a certain methodology like prompt speech, right? Or a certain kind of reading intervention, districts are not obligated by law to put into the recommendation the specific methodology, and they'll resist often doing so. So look, the end result is that the student needs to receive services that are appropriate. If not providing prompt speech is not appropriate in the end, then, you know, that is addressed.
Right.
But, you know, when there are sections in an IEP, like the present levels of performance, where there's a discussion of, you know, where is the student's, you know, baseline levels now at this point? Because from there, so that has to be accurately reflected. It's very important that those present levels of performance, and it's, if you look at your IEP, you know, it's going to be on an area of academics, social development, management needs. And there's a whole section where there's, you know, information coming out of the CSE meeting is input. And it's very important that the language that goes into that is accurate and is reflective of what is discussed at the CSE meeting. Because from there, the district will generate the student's needs. And there's another section which will state the student's needs in those various domains. From those have to also be listed, all of them, and accurately listed.
Yeah.
From there, those needs, goals are derived from those needs.
Yeah.
So then when we turn to the goal section, there should be a goal that addresses the need.
Yeah.
So it's very important that all of this is incorporated into an IEP.
Yeah.
It comes from the evaluations. It comes from the discussion at the CSE meeting. And it's a job. Like, again, if a parent goes to, you know, parents can certainly do this on their own. Some parents may need somebody to make sure that certain, you know, aspects or points get into that IEP to make sure that the goals are, that are generated are appropriate and measurable. So it's just a very important piece because at the end of the day, that's your child's program.
Yeah. And I will also add that being a meaningful participant doesn't just occur at meetings. I often hear parents say, oh, I don't have enough communication from the school. And I say, well, when was the last time you reached out and invited the teacher to have a conversation? Or have you initiated a communication notebook? Even if the teacher hasn't, and maybe the teacher should, but have you shown them that you're here for an open line of communication, that you want that, that you expect that from them? And if the answer is no, well, then get on it. You have to sometimes be the fire starter here. And that doesn't mean the other people involved won't communicate or don't want to, but everyone has a different personality. Everyone has different expectations. It's important for you to share your expectations and demonstrate that, hey, I'm a leader in the home. I know you are the leader in the school. Let's work together. I've been so pleasantly surprised by how much communication I get when I extend the olive branch to my child's teachers. They then realize, oh, this isn't home versus school. They want to work together. We share so much information. And it's been so heartening for me as a parent that when I do that, they've even adapted some of my child's goals to be more supportive of his needs after seeing some of the things he's doing at home with me, which has been wonderful. So don't assume that just because you're sitting at opposite sides of the meeting table, that you can't work together in between meetings. It's an ebbing and flowing process that happens all the time. And though it takes work and time and energy, it benefits your child no matter how old they are. And that's the ultimate goal.
Yeah, well, exactly, Sarah. And really, consistency is so key here. And so the communication is important to understand what's happening in school so that it can be carried over at home. And without that communication, there can be a real disconnect.
Right.
And, you know, we often wind up seeing different behaviors, inconsistent behaviors. And so, you know, communication is, you know, it's so important.
Susan, I have one more question, and then I would love any parting information that you think is important to close with. But if you have a client or someone who's a prospective client, and I hear this a lot, I've shown the district that there is a need. I've sent the teachers the videos. I've shown them at my IEP meetings of what my child does at home, and they're not really being supported in school. And it sort of becomes a disagreement. You know, I'm seeing that my child needs this. You're not agreeing with me. What do you advise this parent? Do they right away get on a call with a lawyer, explore some options, ask some questions? I think many of them make the assumption, and maybe it's an incorrect assumption, that my district doesn't want to work with me or they don't want to support me. And we don't always know if that's true.
Right. I mean, look, I think that they need to make their concerns and their requests very clear. Sometimes there's miscommunication or misinterpretation. So, you know, they may want to follow up with the district, you know, with a letter of the concerns that they feel have not been resolved. You know, a team meetings with teachers, meetings with administrative staff. Those steps should be taken for sure, but with clarity. You know, if there continues to be disagreement, then a parent may choose to go to an advocate or speak to an attorney about, well, what are their rights? so that they have an understanding. Is what I'm asking for, you know, am I entitled to it, or is it something that is I'm not entitled to, and the district, you know, just can't do it, and that's reasonable. I need to pay for it myself. Or, you know, is this something that should be provided through my school district? So, I mean, parents may not know, parents will probably not know the answer to that question. So, you know, they'll need to consult with somebody who can answer that question.
Amazing. And do you have any closing points that you want to make that you really want parents to absorb?
Well, you know, the biggest piece I feel like I touched on, which is, you know, being prepared, not just going into your meeting and opening a situation up to, you know, feeling intimidated or ambushed. That's not, you know, you need to sort of take charge of the situation. Realize that you are a meaningful participant and member of the CSC team, and knowledge is power. The more you know about your child's needs, the more you have obtained through comprehensive evaluations, the more you will be able to advocate with data, not just, I want this because I see this and I think this is would help. We need to have the information, the data, preparation, and be prepared.
Yeah. When you and I had our initial conversation about what we wanted to highlight on this episode, and we talked about the homeschool versus home instruction thing, and one of the things you said really stood out to me. It said, you know, when families remove the district of the obligation to educate their child with needs, there's systemic consequences to that. The district never changes if every student who's nonverbal leaves the district and homeschools, for example. How can we expect districts to evolve and change and grow and provide a wider variety of resources if we're kind of saying you don't have to? And so I think, you know, I was thinking about this, and I was also thinking about, you know, families I know. I live in the Hamptons, and it's a small year-round community, though right now in the summer, it's exploded with people. And there are a lack of resources in this part of New York, and there have been for many years. And in a neighboring town, I know a family who went to the newspapers and they went to politicians and they had town meetings and they really exhausted themselves trying to create change in their town, and they were not successful. And ultimately, what got change going in their town was them advocating for their own child more. And when the district realized, oh, this family is saying no, they are proving their point in an organized fashion, we have to listen to them, we have to make some changes, it started changing the situation not only for their child, but other children in their town as well. And so I want everyone listening to know that it can seem like a big undertaking to advocate for your child and show up these meetings like a powerhouse and be ready to go. But it's not just about your child. It's about every child who comes after. And I've seen this in my own experience, in my own life. When you have those hard moments and you're up late at night preparing for your meeting or reviewing the reports and making notes and asking questions, remember that it's for your child, but it's not just for your child. You're part of a bigger difference that's being made in your community. And for me, that always keeps me going when I feel tired or when I feel depleted. I remind myself, it's not just my kid that's going to benefit from this. And I know that you see this all the time, Susan. It's one person who creates the change and the ripple effects are felt by many. So I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for being on this podcast, because I think your type of law is very special and unique. And I'm very grateful that people like you exist and do this work for people who often don't have a voice, literally, of their own, and you are their voice. And I cannot express my gratitude enough. I know a lot of people are going to listen to this and probably have questions for you. Would you be kind enough to tell people how they can find you?
Sure. So they can look up, you know, the firm, which is, and look up my website, which is www.susandeedy.com. And they can call the office, speak to Kathy, and sort of express what their interest is, and we'll take it from there.
And I know you lead workshops, so I'm probably going to be in your inbox asking you to lead one with me, because I think that our people would really benefit from that and help them to be more empowered, meaningful participants of their meetings. So this is the first of many conversations I will probably ask you to have with me, and I'm excited about it. So thank you so much for being on the podcast today. Everyone, thank you for listening. I'll put Susan's website in the show notes as well. And always feel free to reach out. You know where to find us. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. Bye.
If today's show resonated with you, please leave a review through your favorite podcast provider, as it's an important step in allowing new listeners to find us when they need to hear this message in their own lives.